The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to Inside Medical Nutrition Podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Nia Patel. Today's episode is part of a career support series, and I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Dimitris Koutakidis, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Oxford. Hi, Dimitris. It's fantastic to have you on the podcast. And today's podcast is all about talking to dietitians who work in research. So just to kick off, it would be fantastic if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself, where you're based and what your current role is. So three questions in there, but perhaps start with a little bit more about yourself.
Thank you, Linnea. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me. My name is Dimitris. I'm a senior research fellow at the University of Oxford at the NAFL Department of Primary Care Health Sciences. I'm a dietitian by background, and my research is focusing on finding and testing weight loss programs for the treatment of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Okay, we're definitely going to talk a lot more about that.
Yeah.
If we just go back, so did you go straight into research or did you work clinically as a dietitian first?
So I did my undergrad in dietetics in Greece, and after that I came to London for a master's, and during that I had a very interesting master's project looking at fruit and vegetable intake in children and how this is associated with the fruit and vegetable intake of their parents. So that got me thinking, oh, I want to do a little bit more research and so on. And I was very lucky to be accepted for a PhD straight after my master's. So I continued with the PhD and then, yeah, carried on with research after that.
No, fantastic. So did we go back to your master's? So I'm assuming that if parents ate fruit and vegetables, their children were more likely to eat fruit and vegetables,
yeah.
Right? So your focus initially was on kind of diet and behavioral science. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And I think it still remains exactly the same. I've always found that this is the biggest nut to crack, how we can try to influence people's behavior for good.
Absolutely.
And help them have a healthier diet. And if this is the right thing for them, and if this is going to actually help them improve their disease or manage their disease. So it has now shifted a little bit towards the disease side at the moment, but it always has this core focus of trying to see how we can help them change their behavior.
No, fantastic. So what was your PhD in? Was it in the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or did you do something?
It was completely different. Back then, I developed and tested a health eating and physical activity program for women who have finished treatment for endometrial cancer. So it was all about trying to think how we can support people who have finished treatment for cancer take on the next step and improve their quality of life.
Okay. And what did you find?
So what we found was that this program was acceptable and helpful to people, and most of them improved their diet, and it seemed that it might be improving their quality of life as well. It was a small study, so everything was fairly preliminary at the moment, but it did show quite a good promise.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And now your interest is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So what projects are you currently working on now?
So at the moment, I am running two trials which look at the effect of intensive weight loss programs in people who have established liver disease. So essentially, what we're testing is low-energy total diet replacement programs where we ask people to replace their food with soup, shakes, and bars that we provide to them for a set period of time. And then after that, they slowly start building healthier eating habits with the support of the dietitian. And what we want to see is whether this very rapid weight loss is, first of all, a safe thing to do from a liver point of view.
Okay.
And then if that's the case, if it is also a helpful and effective thing to see if this actually improves the disease.
Okay. So the liver disease that we're referring to is related to obesity, right? And we know that obviously obesity is on the rise. And so as a result of that, we're seeing more of this non-fatty liver disease.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. You know, interesting. Yes. And then what's your other project on?
So so both of these trials are in the spectrum of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So we have one project which looks at moderately advanced liver disease and one that looks at fairly advanced liver disease. So we want to see at each of these stages of the disease, as the disease progresses, whether the weight loss is safe and effective, because we do know that it is probably quite a good thing if it is very early on during the disease stage. But as the disease progresses, we don't as of yet know if it is a good thing or not.
Okay. With my kind of, and you're a dietitian too, so with dietitian to dietitian practical hat on, people working on the ground, perhaps working with obesity, I mean, how are they going to know whether someone has got this level of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or an advanced stage? And what are the telltale things that dietitians perhaps working this area need to start looking out for? From the research you've also you're doing at the moment, how can they start adapting that into the practice that they're the work that they're doing?
So it is something that is typically diagnosed incidentally. So people don't typically have symptoms for it, and it's just that they happen to have an ultrasound or a blood test for X, Y, or Z other reason. And based on that, the liver also pops up as a problem. And then people go through series of investigations through their GPs and through the liver doctors, and this is how they end up being diagnosed with a condition. But what we typically seems to be what the clinical guidelines at the moment recommend is that all health professionals ask people to do healthier changes in terms of their diet, physical activity, and lose some weight. The challenge is, as always, how is this actually being implemented in practice? Yeah. Because what we do know from our research is that when people do get support to make the changes and to lose weight, they are much, much more successful than when they're trying to do it alone after somebody has just told them to do so.
Yeah. And is there a difference between the calorie-restricted diets that you're looking at within your research and just healthy, balanced eating, but just perhaps watching portion sizes?
That's an interesting question. I think that the big difference that exists is, as you say, on the amount of calories somebody is having. Because
so it's a calorie thing. It's not necessarily a food group thing. So it's not about, say, carbohydrates or something like that.
It's for the fatty liver side of things, it's typically the calorie thing. We haven't seen strong evidence that it's specific to a micronutrient or a micronutrient. So it's typically down to the calories. And if you can achieve the same amount of calorie restriction, whichever way you can do it, my guess would be that it probably wouldn't necessarily matter much, and you would probably going to get the same effect.
Okay. And remind me, in terms of calorie range, have you found a specific calorie range that seems to be most effective?
Not necessarily. But what we have seen is that people who go on a substantially lower calorie regime, such as the one that we're testing at the moment, is 860 calories. And what we
have
seen
for both men and women.
For both men and women. And what we have seen is that people in such strict programs tend to do way much better.
Okay. And how long are they going on these programs for?
They're typically 3 to 4 months on the soups and shakes, and then slowly they start reintroducing food. So
every
it's
day.
Quite every day, yes. So it's quite demanding, certainly, and it is tough. But what the people actually say is that they find it much easier than they thought it would be.
Okay, so compliance is actually better than you think.
Compliance is very good, and there are a few reasons for that. I think the first reason is that people are actually losing weight, and this really, really motivates them to keep going. And the products typically are formulated in a way that makes them feel full and not extremely hungry. And of course, they have lots of support throughout this period that keeps them motivated and engaged in the program.
Okay. And have you done any research looking at the long-term impact? So we know that the short-term 8 weeks makes a massive difference, as you've said in your findings. But what about 6 months or a year or 2 years down the line? What happens?
So what we see is that up to the point of 6 weeks, up to the point of 6 months, people continue to lose weight. Most people continue to lose weight. Of course, there is quite a bit of variability depending on the person, but on average, we do see that the weight keeps going down by 6 months. At 6 months is when we typically stop supporting them, because this is when the projects finish or the intervention finishes and the support from the dietitian stops. And after that, we do see a small amount of weight regain at 1 month and at 1 year, at 2 years and 3 years, based on other trials in the field. Now, the good thing from that is that although there is an expected weight regain, it is much less than what people have expected. And people, even 3 years down the line, haven't actually reached their baseline weight that they started with. They're still probably around 6 kilos lighter.
Okay. I guess the million-dollar question, Dimitris, being a dietitian, would be, okay, so you found this within your research. So what would your top tips then be clinically if you were working within obesity with perhaps patients who had this? Would you change your practice based on what you found?
So I think changing practice requires a lot of different things. And I think many times it does start from the top, where we're trying to influence the way the guidelines, if our research findings are supporting this, we're trying to see whether the guidelines for the obesity treatment, as well as for the fatty liver treatment, could support the provision of such programs. There has been a huge expansion of these types of interventions and programs throughout the NHS at the moment, which seems to be, and they do seem to be as helpful as we see them in trials. So I would really expect that in a few years' time, this is probably going to be something that people will be using with much more ease.
Yeah.
I think at the moment there is a lot of caution from which is understandable, because it's not something that is extremely widely available, something that people have been used to do, because what we typically learn when we are at university is about portion control, healthy eating, and so on and so forth. So I think having this as something that is new is something that will take a little bit of time for people to get familiar, to get trained to do it, feel confident to deliver it as dietitians. And then when they do actually see the results, I think most people are likely to be convinced about it. Before I joined my research group here in Oxford, I was the biggest skeptic of anything beyond the sort of standard healthy eating dietary advice. And I think the thing that tipped it for me was the data that I saw, and seeing this, not only the massive weight losses comparatively with other programs that we have, but also the improvements in the health status of patients, the qualitative data that people say how much more confident and pleased they were by being on this program. And I think we do need the data, and we do need to keep having more and more data on this and many other diet interventions to see what works and for whom, because clearly there is no program that will work for everybody, single person.
Yeah.
So we do need to offer options to our patients.
Yeah, I guess there's two thoughts going on in my mind. I'll talk about the first one, then we talk about the second one. The first one would be, I suppose, I would be a bit skeptical of the low-calorie diet in terms of, okay, fine for a short period of time, but isn't there going to be an increased loss in muscle mass? And isn't it then going to affect the metabolic rate, which then on the long term will have an impact? So tell me about that. What are your thoughts?
So our data don't suggest that this is the case. What they suggest is that the amount of fat-free mass loss is about 25%, which is typically exactly the same as with any other weight loss program, whether you go rapidly or not. So I have been very relieved to see that because you do come with it with a question in your head, how is it going to be? But actually, the majority of the weight loss that you lose is fat mass.
Interesting. And then I guess also because I'm from public health and your expertise is behavioral sciences. So the big question for me is, okay, this has to be sustainable in the long term. And sure. A lot of perhaps the interventions that we see within primary care, perhaps that are very extreme, are great, achieve the results, get all the markers that we want medically down. But after a while, because we haven't had the behavior change, the weight creeps back up. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think there are 2 points here. I think the first point is that we probably have to see weight loss and weight loss maintenance as two different entities where we probably need different, we need to practice different behaviors.
Oh, interesting.
It seems what the data suggests is that diet is very much important for very important for weight loss, way more important than physical activity. But it might be that we need a bit of both for weight loss maintenance.
Yeah.
So we probably have to think of different behavioral strategies for the two different points. And the other point is that I think we have to think a little bit about how much intervention time and how much support we give to the people, because I think it's a little bit unrealistic to have a 3 month or a 6 month program or a 1 year program and expect that things are going to be entirely different 10 years down the line. When you think of things like medication for type 2 diabetes, for hypertension, for dyslipidemia, they are not things that you take for 3 months and then your heart is improved for 10 or 15 years. It's something that you have to do for a very long time. So what this means is that we probably do need programs that provide support from dietitians for a much longer period of time. Of course, this it does come with a cost, and it does come with a substantial force of people, if you like. But it probably is necessary for when we're looking at something that is such a long-term issue.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love the fact that we need to separate it out. It's weight loss, achieving weight loss needs an intervention where it's more dietary focused, because there's a saying, abs are made in the kitchen, not in the gym. And then actually in terms of maintenance, looking at perhaps the physical activity and the diet, and then looking at the perfect optimal touch points, which perhaps a dietitian could be involved in as well. And it would be amazing if we can, as you say, get that implemented more in kind of current guidelines so that we have that support, which I think in my mind, that would be an effective way of putting interventions into practice. So we've talked a lot about your research and I could keep talking about it, but I actually want to talk about your job in general. So how do you find the research world? You're clearly very passionate about it. Is it all enjoyment?
I think it's mostly enjoyment. I think otherwise, I think I should have found another job. It certainly comes with a lot of moments of rejection because the majority of our time, or a very good chunk of it at least, is applying for funding and writing grant applications. And 90% of those are being rejected for X, Y, or Z reasons. So it is a job that you do need to cultivate a thick skin as you go along, and be able to, yeah, withstand this rejection, not only for the grant applications, but also for the papers that you're publishing and so on and so forth.
Different researchers having different theories and thoughts and things like that. Okay. Exactly. So I guess that's what keeps you up at night, is this, the grant applications that you're constantly trying to apply for?
And my little baby girl.
Oh, yes, congratulations.
But certainly the grant application side of things, and how we can find more effective ways to influence policy and research, and what's essentially the next big idea.
And then how have you toughened your skin? Because, you know, coming up from being a dietitian, we get more or less the same training. And I guess then going into a world that is researchers are very different to what we were trained in. How have you found that evolution? How have you prepared yourself? And what have you had to learn to make sure that you are being successful at what you do?
I'm not sure how much I have changed in this sort of sense, but I think it is about reminding yourself that this is part of the game. And you have to come and accept that the rejection is part of the game, because otherwise it is very hard, and you can always take it very personally, because you put your blood, your sweat and your tears into all sorts of all these kind of grant applications and papers and so on and so forth. And then somebody says, no, that's not good. So I think that's the one. The second bit is that I have been very fortunate to be able to be supported for a substantial amount of time. And because I was on a 5-year postdoc, so this gave me the opportunity to, it afforded me the opportunity to be able to be rejected many, many times and not have the typical 6 months or 1 year contract. So I think I was lucky from that sense. And perhaps the third one, which is probably as important as the other two, is having the support both at home and professionally here to cheer you up and make you keep going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what exciting research projects have you got ahead of you in the future?
I think the exciting bits are we have talked about projects in cirrhosis and in fatty liver disease, which are currently ongoing, and hopefully they will have quite exciting data. And if that will be the case, we do plan to have making the case for much bigger trials and trying to influence a much bigger proportion of the population in a good way, hopefully. The other very interesting project that we have in mind at the moment is looking back at my cancer days, if you like, and trying to see how we can help people who are due to have surgery for cancer with a diet intervention.
Okay, is that any types of cancer or specific to
To bowel cancer, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. That's super exciting. Yeah, looking forward to seeing those publications. I'll look out for
them. Hopefully,
And so what, if our listeners are wanting to get involved in research or perhaps look at taking a more academic career, what top tips would you have?
I think the first top tip would be get in touch with whoever academic you want to, for an academic in a topic that you are interested in following. I think this is how it started with me, by cold emailing professors that were doing very interesting work from what I thought was interesting. Yeah. And nine times out of ten, you do get a reply.
They're receptive. Yeah, especially now with social media.
Exactly. So definitely get in touch. If you work in a hospital setting or through the NHS, there are typically quite a lot of opportunities at the moment for allied health professionals to do research placements, a little bit of research training, and all these kind of things always help you explore if this is the right thing for you and if you like that kind of job. So it's about giving it a go. And then I guess the third one comes back to persevering. And yeah, if things don't work out the first time, just try a little bit more.
Yeah, because I suppose you're always learning. And yeah. I guess you see it within one research grant wasn't accepted, then you learn for the next one.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's a huge learning opportunity. You learn even by the rejection, you have learned so much in the process that you can then apply to the next one much more quickly and much more efficiently. And yeah, that's a win.
Exactly. Well, you're definitely in a career that is exciting and one that where you're constantly learning. I'm very excited to see what comes out of all the research you're doing, and then more importantly, how that gets put into guidelines and how that changes practice of dietitians. So really inspiring, really wonderful talking to you, Dimitris. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues and consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.